How's it going, everybody? Brian Alvarez and Dave Meltzer here on Wrestling Observer Radio, April 12th, 2011, here at figure4online.com/wrestlingobserver.com. Joined today by Chris Hero. We're going to talk about the career of Larry Sweeney. And Chris, how are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty well, considering.
All things considered. Yeah, we wanted to make sure we started off here at the top of the show today. Apparently, there were some other websites yesterday that had reported that Sweeney was battling drug issues or had drug issues and attributed it to our website and apparently was misconstruing something that Dave had said on our show yesterday when talking about his issues with his own medication. And Chris, you knew him better than most, so I want to make sure you had a chance to talk about that here a bit.
Yeah, I would say if he had any drug issues or battling with any kind of drug problems, it would be in early 2009 when he stopped taking his medication. I think he was on lithium or something like that, and his prescription had run out, and he just thought it was like, okay, I don't need it anymore. And that is just kind of what began his descent into his rapid cycling bipolar for a good portion of 2009. Now, he did drink, and especially when he was having his manic phases, he was definitely drinking too much. But aside from that, the whole time I knew him, he never had any kind of drug addiction whatsoever. I mean, I'm not a drug guy as it is, but yeah, there was no buzz around that you know, Alex was addicted to something or using stuff regularly.
Now, when you mentioned that his prescription expired and he decided, well, I don't need it anymore, was this like a new prescription for something that he had gone on recently, or had he been on something for quite a while, and for whatever reason, when this particular prescription ran out, he decided that he was healed?
Well, in all the years that we had traveled, Alex had a very colorful life. You know, he grew up in Chicago. His parents were, you know, pretty well off. You know, his family was pretty well off. And he felt himself to be a little different. So he went and experimented and tried some things. Like, he moved to India for a while. He was a traveling carny, you know, for several months. And he was just trying to, you know, figure out who he was. He went to Oberlin College in Ohio, which is more of a, you know, an art-oriented type school. And throughout that time, he was just really having difficulties figuring out who he was. And that's where a lot of the depression came from. There was an incident in high school, I believe, where he was involved in a car accident that, you know, is his negligence. He was just goofing around driving, and, you know, a bunch of his friends were in the car, and one of his friends got badly hurt and, you know, did not recover very well from that accident. So he took that to heart, and, you know, from a very young age, and he just carried that with him. And I know throughout college he had some, you know, some strong difficulties with depression, and he beat him, you know, because by the time I met him, he was well-adjusted, and he had these stories. But there was nothing that he exhibited that gave any of us a reason to believe that he needed his medication that badly. You know, we've been talking about it the last couple of days. It was 2 years ago when everything hit, and it was just such a shock. I'd never seen anybody transform quite like that. I knew what bipolar disorder was. I'd heard about it, but I just thought it was kind of like extreme mood swings. I never really, you know, I just wasn't educated on the fact. And then once I started witnessing how he was behaving, it was intense. You know, he was doing and saying things that, it's very similar to the whole Charlie Sheen thing. That's why when all this Charlie Sheen stuff happened, it's kind of hard to, you know, some stuff was amusing, but it was really hard to find humor in it, because that's the exact same stuff I saw my friend going through. And, you know, it's not somebody acting out to get attention. It's just they legitimately have these delusions that, you know, they'll ramble for, you know, 30, 40, 50 minutes, and half of what they say is right on point, and you're with them, and then all of a sudden they just kind of go off the deep end and say some insane things. You know, Alex was a very spiritual person, so we would talk a lot about reincarnation and things like that. And he was just so intelligent. He could kind of talk you into, you know, whatever nonsense he was spewing. And I mean, we all loved him and cared about him so much that we would humor him and just let him go off on these tirades. So there you have it.
Now, when these problems really started happening, I mean, you know, in a lot of ways, he let the world know. I mean, it was pretty obvious that, like, you know, something was going on. And anybody that knew him or even, you know, there were a lot of fans that didn't know him. And the stories were, you know, everybody knew something was up. And then, I mean, to me at least, it seemed like in the last, I don't know, 8, 9, 10 months, he just kind of really dropped off the radar. And you know, I kept in touch with him quite a bit, you know, a few years back. And then, you know, he disappeared and it would be long stretches of time before I heard from him. And, you know, he'd talk about how he was doing better and that sort of thing. And, I mean, how closely did you keep in touch with him over the last 8 months? And what were things really like during that period?
I would say, you know, it's kind of sad, but I can't actually recall the last time I spoke with him. I knew it was either December or January, but sometime around then. It was kind of foggy. And then I tried to keep up with him via Facebook after that because, you know, he let his phone plan run out and he just no longer had a phone.
Yeah.
I was trying to keep up with him online and just wasn't hearing back from him. Fortunately, I have a pretty good friendship with his ex-girlfriend, Amy, and she was kind of like his best friend. She lives in California right now. At one point, she lived in Hawaii, so she was all the way across the world. And she was, you know, she was his savior. She really understood him. They grew up together. They went to the same high school, so she knew him way before any wrestling, anything like that. And when he was at his worst, she was always there to kind of help him out and kind of guide him. When things got really bad and he was in and out of jail in, you know, summer of 2009, and living on the streets and, you know, being picked up for vagrancy, all that bad stuff, she came all the way from Hawaii to Chicago, found him, and, you know, she had a phone conversation with him a couple days before that was like, hey, if I come to Chicago, will you check yourself in? And he's like, yeah, sure, you know, not expecting her to show up. And, you know, she showed up, and she found him and got him checked in, and he was in some sort of a medical place, some sort of institution where, you know, for 1 week straight, and that actually was the catalyst for getting him back on track or where he needed to be. And, you know, in the last couple of years, he's still struggled to get his head above water. He put himself in a great deal of debt that summer. He was just running up cards here and there and renting cars and living out of hotels and just... He was, it's kind of amusing now to look back on at some of the things he was doing. He kind of got hooked up with some spiritual healer, and he was buying like these moon rocks and just medallions and stuff like that, which to the person that didn't know him, it just went along with his character very well. And he's just wearing all these crazy gaudy jewelry. I kind of lost my train of thought with the medallion.
You brought something up that just triggered something with me, and I remember when this would have been when he split with Ring of Honor, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden, I just remember in conversations with him, he would go off on just how much in debt all of a sudden he was, which, like 2 months earlier, you never heard, I mean, at least to me, you know, never heard a word about it, and then all of a sudden, you know, it was just like, oh my God, I'm in, you know, financial trouble.
Yeah.
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 Was that kind of like after,
you know,
his fall?
He chipped away a bit at that recently, but he was still having difficulties. And like I said, he went down to Louisiana. You know, he met some people down there, and they offered to put him up, and, you know, he could kind of just try to live, you know, live very cheaply. I think he was getting a little bit of disability money to help him out. And, you know, wrestling a bit. He was wrestling sporadically. It wasn't I think his last match was against Chaz Taylor pretty recently. And, he stayed in contact with a couple people. And, what was I going to say?
Now, I actually have another question here about the medication. I mean, when you talk about he had a lot of problems and he was living on the street and being picked up for vagrancy, I mean, was part of the issue for a while there that he could not afford medication?
I don't think it was that. Not that he was rolling in money, but the part of the sickness is it tells you that you don't have to take anything and that taking the drugs is going to make you worse.
Sure.
So he just felt that things were right with the world. When that prescription ran out and he stopped taking his stuff, he genuinely he felt okay. He felt like like the universe had spoken to him and had forgiven him for what he had done previously and that he could get on with his life and that he had great things to accomplish and he needed to start doing them. And just anything that happened to him, he could just put a positive spin on at that point in time. Anything that was going on, like, oh, it's no problem. I'll just do this and it'll be all right. And that was just a part of his rapid cycling bipolar, because he'd take any bad situation and turn it into something good for him. Now, as far as the last couple months, he was involved in a real bullshit DUI. What legitimately happened, unfortunately, there was a similar Kurt Angle situation, so unfortunately, it's going to kind of get caught up in that. But what happened was he wanted to get drunk. So he drove to a liquor store, he bought some, bought some alcohol, and then drove sober to a church parking lot, of all places, and parked his car. He turned on Howard Stern and started drinking and ended up falling asleep to Howard Stern. And when the cops got there, the key was in the ignition, so they gave him a DUI for that, regardless of the fact that his engine was cold, so there's no way he was driving whatsoever while he was under the influence. So they were going to take him to court, and he'd spoken with his lawyer, and it was something that he could beat, but for some reason or another, he slept through the court date, and he missed it, so they were looking for him. And he was worried about going to jail, obviously, and he didn't want to be, he didn't want to have a felony, and he was kind of thinking about making a run for it, and it just made sense to him to just kind of end things, I assume. It wasn't something he talked about. I know Amy had spoken with him the night before, and he was in good spirits. She was positive, maybe too positive. So yeah, it caught everybody by surprise.
He'd posted on Facebook the night before as well, and seemed fine. And
actually, I think it was a post about Dr. Roma Scavige, the legendary Pennsylvania doctor that would work with the WWE guys.
And it was kind of, in some ways it was different, but Adam Firestorm passed away. He was an independent guy up here in BC. And, in the era of Facebook and Twitter and everything like that, it's always kind of like, it's weird when someone passes away and you go up and, the day before he ended his life, he's posting on his Facebook wall and everything seems fine. And kind of seemed like that with Larry as well. And, we'd written on the front page that he was found at a wrestling school. And was he living there
Yeah, I think they had put him up there. I don't know those people, so I don't know for sure. But I think that's where he was crashing at that time.
Okay. Now, I guess to talk about some of the positive things about his life, obviously.
Absolutely.
One of the just greatest managers of the last decade. And, I talked about this yesterday on the show. If he'd come around, 20 years earlier, if he would have kept his head on straight, he probably would have been talked about as like an all-time great. And when did you first meet him? And I guess talk a little bit about the talent that was Larry Sweeney.
Yeah, I moved to Pennsylvania in the summer of 2004 to help co-train the Chikara School with Quackenbush. And I think it was dinner after a show where I first met Alex, and it was completely insignificant. It was just like, hey, that's a new trainee. Hey, okay, cool, whatever. And he was, quiet and, not really shy, but he just didn't really say much, like a trainee should. And it wasn't until he started attending some of my training and his personality started showing a little bit. And the guys kind of spoke about this, his promo ability. And Chikara at that time was way more focused on in-ring. So for just some new guy to step in out of the gate and have crazy good promos. It was something special. So just over time, his promos before the shows, Smart Mark Video would pull everybody aside, and a couple guys had a couple promos to cut, and everybody would watch to see what Alex had to say. And it was his content, it was his delivery. He just owned the camera. He just had this certain way about him, just from the beginning. And the thing is, his personality came out more as we all became friends. But he was kind of a quieter guy, and I'm sure growing up he was a quieter guy. But he really embraced that, and just had such a captivating personality, and it was really something special. And he was incredibly inexperienced. He'd only had two or three matches when he started having these awesome promos that were going around the tape trading world at this this new throwback character, Sweet and Sour Larry Sweeney.
And you'd mentioned that he'd been on our show and talked about his days as a carny, and like a legit carny. He worked at the carnivals, running the whack-a-mole machine or whatever it was, and traveled from place to place. And you talked about him going to India. And, he really kind of did it all.
He did. He was very cultured. And, wrestling was a huge part of his life. But he could relate to anybody. And he was just the master of finding unique people. It would just be, he could be at a restaurant or he'd be at a gas station and just strike up a conversation with just some random individual. And he would find out these crazy details about people, and he just had a very magnetic personality, and it just made for some incredible stories, a lot of laughs. And, what it came down to, he was just a genuinely good person with a heart of gold, and it was infectious. There was very rare to be around him and not having a good time.
Did he ever talk to you about his inability to make it to WWE? I mean, obviously he did the thing as Nick Hogan, but a lot of people who saw his talent, I mean, it was like, God, this guy should be in WWE, and it never happened. Did he ever talk to you about that?
Not really. He didn't start talking a lot about WWE until he left Ring of Honor. He had mentioned it before, but not at any length. And I just kind of wrote that off because it was when he was just kind of going on his tirades at that time. We all knew he was incredibly talented, and the thing was, he became good in the ring. Like, he was never, five star mat worker or anything, but his Ring of Honor days, he was strictly a manager. He had, two matches, three matches, something like that. So that's what people remember most of his work. But on the side, he was doing these other shows. He worked a lot for IWC in Pittsburgh. He worked a lot for Chikara. And he was just the master of getting himself out there. He would do smaller shows and work main events. And, he was really good at controlling a crowd. As far as WWE went, he knew his size was an issue wrestling-wise, but he was willing to do whatever to get his personality out there. And he even started experimenting as time went on, as changing his promos. Sometimes he would do kind of like a Jake-style promo where it was kind of quiet, or sometimes he would just be over the top, screaming and doing whatever. So he could really pull it all off.
Now, the last thing I wanted to talk about here, maybe it was just because I was actually down there for this, but the Houston WrestleMania weekend, shortly after he was released from Ring of Honor, and of course he went down there, and he was kind of he was doing matches in the parking lot with like fans, if I recall correctly. That to me kind of seemed like that was sort of the peak of the troubles. Did it escalate from there, or was that kind of where everybody figured out something really needs to be done like fast?
Well, everybody figured he wasn't on the shows. He had been taken off the show, so he flew himself down there.
That's right. Yeah.
To show like, hey, I'm good. I can do the shows. But basically, what happened was we had a weekend prior to that for Ring of Honor, where it was St. Louis and Indianapolis. And, you know, St. Louis, he was just kind of all over the place, and that night he just kind of disappeared. Well, the thing was, he didn't disappear and do anything bad. He ended up, he got his own hotel room somewhere else at a different hotel and just slept in. And so when we were traveling to Indianapolis, nobody could get a hold of him. And shoot, of course, we all assumed the worst. And it was just, everybody's panicking. Jimmy Jacobs is the one that stayed behind and drove around, you know, going to police stations, you know, trying to figure out if something bad happened. And all that happened was he checked into his own hotel room and decided to sleep in. But the thought process that it took to go, you know what, I'm going to stay away from everybody. I'm not going to set an alarm. I'm not going to... It was little things like that is what the warning signs were. Like, something's wrong with him. He's missing flights, but he thinks everything's going to be okay. He doesn't think there's going to be any repercussions. So that weekend, once he got to Indianapolis, he eventually made it to the show. Made it to the show by bell time, which he thought was fine. Like, hey, I made it, guys. And everybody pulled him aside and were like, something's wrong, and he's like, no, nothing's wrong. I'm good. So that was when ROH management decided that him being on shows and in those environments was not good for him, and that, you know, something bad didn't happen soon. It was going to happen eventually, and they didn't want to contribute to that. Everybody just wanted him to get back on his meds and get better. And we thought by taking him off shows that it would that would work, and unfortunately it did not. He thought he was better, so he flew himself down to Houston and just kind of, you know, caused a little bit of a scene and ended up staying in Houston for a while.
Any thoughts very quickly on this past WrestleMania weekend?
I enjoyed myself. I was happy with both the shows that we did, Ring of Honor-wise. Those WrestleMania weekends are always a lot of fun. Just because it's such a spectacle, and there's so many people that come in for that, so you inevitably end up running into people you never thought you'd see. I was just on a corner downtown Atlanta getting ready to cross the street, and I look over, and I'm like, oh, it's Jim Molyneux and Scott Hudson. What's going on, guys? You know, how am I randomly going to run into Scott Hudson?
Sure.
And, you know, just other guys that I've wrestled with throughout the years and been on shows with, or even fans that, you know, busted their asses and made every single show they could. You just see a lot of the same faces. It's a really good experience.
And, of course, in Toronto coming up, you are getting the shot at Eddie Edwards for the title. And excited about that match?
Oh, absolutely. Eddie's one of the hardest workers I've ever known. You know, these countless months spent at the Noah Dojo, and he's finally breaking into his own, or has broken into his own. I mean, he's a world champion. He's finally broken into his own, and his personality's come out. He's just having great matches. I think he and I had a match that was on pace to be an excellent match, and his shoulder got separated, so that kind of got cut a little short. So I'm looking forward to picking up where we left off.
Dave, you have anything else?
Yeah, I was going to ask, you know, when you first met him and started training him, I mean, did he, like you mentioned, he was kind of quiet. I mean, at what point did he, was it just the promos, or did you sense something from his work that he was able to pick the thing up pretty quick?
It would be, even aside from the promos, if they were going through, like, little practice matches and he'd be putting heat on somebody, this is like at a wrestling school with no crowd whatsoever. And just the kind of things he would pull out, the things he would say, he was just very clever. And like I said, just very much a throwback. So we could tell that he had some kind of charisma, some kind of personality, and that while his, you know, his techniques weren't always picture perfect, that he would more than be able to carry the rest of it with his personality. And as time went on, we found out he's a big fan of, you know, Greg the Hammer Valentine and Playboy Buddy Rose and old school characters like that. Whereas guys nowadays breaking in on our level is kind of like, oh, you know, I want to be the new Davey Richards or Low Key or whatever. But he, not that he didn't respect that style, because he did, and he ended up wrestling with a lot of those guys. He preferred old school 80s wrestling, and we sat back many, many times watching different things. And actually, I'll tell a little story here. I had an old WWF tape, a videotape, because I had a dual deck VCR, and we just pop in tapes and, you know, sit around. It'd be like 10, 12 of us watching videotapes. And this, I think, was an old Freebirds compilation. At the end of the tape, there was just some random other footage on there. And I came across a promo, a very, very grainy promo, but we would sit and watch things anyway, regardless of quality back then. And it was Junkyard Dog, Sergeant Slaughter, being interviewed by Mean Gene for an upcoming tag match. And it was just this ridiculous situation where Sergeant Slaughter's like, I needed to find a partner to take on those two, so I went to the ghetto, where even I had to creep and crawl. And I went to the junkyard, and I saw a man guarding it, and I said, will you be my partner against those two? And he said, yes. He was more than happy to, because he's black, and because he's chained. And then, like, Mean Gene, like, cuts him off, like, what is he doing? And then Junkyard Dog just looks into the camera and goes, ain't no doubt about it, baby. Which is where Sweeney got his ain't no doubt about it from. Just a little silly thing on a promo that we watched. Just a crazy, weirdly, oddly racist, not racist promo. Something that made us laugh for hours. He took that and made ain't no doubt about it his catchphrase.
Mm. When he first was brought into Ring of Honor, was there any frustration on his part that it was going to be his manager, or was he really happy that it was his manager? I mean, in his mind, did he think that like his future was going to be managing or wrestling, or did he just kind of not know what his future was going to be?
He was kind of up in the air. He knew at that time, and he voiced it that he didn't think that he was on the in-ring level of the current Ring of Honor product at that time. He's like, I don't, you know, I know that I can't go with these guys and put that Ring of Honor matchup out there. So I'm going to take what I can get and make the best of it. And he did, you know, he stepped in and made an impact right away. He got bumped by Bruno Sammartino, which was pretty awesome. And I think if there was any frustration, it was over time. But a lot of people have little frustrations here or there. It was never anything to where he needed to, you know, bring it up multiple times. It's just something maybe voiced on the road where, like, man, you know, I hope I haven't pigeonholed myself, and, you know, I hope I can still, you know, go out and get bookings.
Did he ever talk about like TNA or WWE, or was he in Ring of Honor? I know that he was a pretty big, he seemed to me at least to be a real big supporter of Ring of Honor until kind of like the switch hit, you know, which was when it was on TV. And I just remember him being so excited about HDNet, and then, you know, like, you know, one taping later, it was just like, you know, it was a 180.
Yeah. I think he didn't say much about TNA or WWE, and I think that was because when he came in, he ended up getting a contract, because that's when we had our pay-per-views before we had TV. So there were Ring of Honor contracts, so he had nothing else going on, so he signed his contract and he was happy to. And then throughout the course of that, I don't even know when his contract expired. It may have expired, you know, when he was taking off shows. But it wasn't like there was any point where he's like, all right, you know, my contract's coming up. I need to get some footage ready to send out so that somebody could take a look at me. So it was not quite an issue. And by the time that we got HDNet, it was actually that first weekend of our HDNet tapings was the first time that I personally witnessed him acting a bit strange. He actually, we had a Connecticut, Philly. We had a triple shot. And he missed his flight to Connecticut. So he didn't do Connecticut. So he did Philly. He made it to Philly. And then he's just acting differently. So that was when I first started noticing things.
And he didn't, you know, he didn't last much longer after that. Because I just remember.
No, he did that Philly taping. That may have been it. He did the Philly taping. He did the Midwest weekend with St. Louis and Indianapolis, and then it was Houston. So by the time we had another TV taping, he was gone.
Yeah. I mean, was there ever any talk? He came back for that one TV commentary.
He did commentary at Final Battle.
Yeah.
He came back, and it was a surprise. You know, Kerry had, you know, surprised everybody and, you know, didn't tell any of us, and then brought him in. And it's like, holy shit, there he is. What's up, man? It was great to see him. His hair was no longer blonde. He had let that natural hair color grow out. And, he was, you know, quiet. He was kind of reserved. And he, you know, we're thinking like, okay, cool. You know, this is good seeds planted for him coming back and doing something. It just didn't quite happen.
Yeah.
Anything else, Dave?
I guess that's it.
Well, Chris, I want to thank you for doing the show today. I'm sorry it's under these circumstances, but
no problem. Let me finish by just saying that as we look back on it, you know, all of us that were good friends with him and, you know, colleagues or whatever you want to call it, it's kind of crazy to think that we only knew him for a couple years. It was only, you know, like 4 or 5 years at most, but it was really intense. And he was, you know, a great performer, but aside from that, he was just a great guy, like I said, with a heart of gold. And he just had an infectious personality. There's, you know, hundreds and hundreds of hilarious road stories, just silly little inside jokes and stuff that are always going to make us smile. And, you know, regardless of how bleak things looked at one time, I'm really glad that it wasn't 2 years ago that he passed. And, you know, it's kind of similar to Candido, you know, cleaning up his act and then, you know, making another run and, you know, unfortunately passing then. But if Candido had passed away, you know, at the depth of his problems, you know, he'd be looked at a little differently. And I'd kind of like people to look at Sweeney the same way, because while, you know, he chose to end his life, you know, who knows if he was completely of sound mind. He was taking his medication at that time. I mean, I don't know how regularly or what, but he was definitely taking his medication, and he wasn't crazy anymore. He just had issues. So I'm glad that he wasn't at the bottom of the barrel when this happened. And, you know, his family doesn't have to worry any longer. His friends, we don't have to wonder if he's on the streets or, you know, we all know what's going on. And, you know, we all care about him a lot. He affected us greatly, and we've got so many good memories to remember him by. So I feel really fortunate for that. And if anything, it's, you know, the selfish, you know, I wish I could, you know, see him again or talk with him again or, you know, have a road trip with him again. So he left us way more good than bad.
When you, do you believe that it was like the fear of going to jail that may have been the thing that did it? Or
absolutely. I think he just felt like he was under a mountain, and I think it just, and it wasn't just, it's years, you know, he was almost 30. 30, almost 30, something like that, 29, 30.
29, yeah, I was going to try to read this year,
yeah. He was 29, and these problems go back way into high school, you know, so half of his life. You know, he's been battling with this. He, you know, he thought he was, you know, maybe going to go to jail. He didn't know how he was going to handle that. Didn't know how he was going to handle the debt. He really felt like he was, you know, at the bottom of a hole, you know, trying to claw his way out of it, and he just could not get the momentum that he wanted. So I think it was that rather than him having a crazy manic phase and just going off and doing something like that. So everybody's got their own opinions on suicide and such, and oh, it's awful, it sucks. But
you know, I mean,
the one thing on
manic depressive is sometimes the drugs that you take, you know, they also have those side effects that, you know, can lead to suicide.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
kind of make you mellow out and just think everything's okay.
So, yeah.
So yeah, I'm not educated enough in that area to really Currently,
you know, no. I mean, there's been people in the business with this that, you know, have, you know, the regulating the meds with when you're bipolar is a real, real tricky deal. You know, too much, too little, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I mean, I've talked to a lot of people on that didn't know, that have had that, have gone years and years and years through doctor after doctor after doctor, through, you know, and just be, you know, really, really messed up. And then somehow they may find the right doctor who just gets that right balance and you know, and they're okay. But, yeah. You know, but it's still always a constant battle.
Yeah. And, I mean, if anything else, it's just a reminder to all of us that how tricky things can be. And, you know, personally, I feel, you know, the world, our country, whatever, is over-medicated. And I think people take too much medicine for stuff like that. However, with a situation like this, it shows you how serious a chemical imbalance is, how serious a disease like this is, and that if you do not attend to it, there'll be a, you know, a potential downward spiral. So, you know, I think it's just a good reminder for everybody that comes across a situation like this in the future to, you know, to just take it seriously. And I don't want to give the impression that this situation wasn't taken seriously, because it was. And there were a lot of people that were trying to help Alex, and there were a lot of people that did help Alex. But at the end of the day, it was his decision to move to Louisiana and to get away from all that and just kind of, like, try to correct things on his own. And, you know, there were very few people that he stayed in contact with. And, you know, like I said, his ex-girlfriend, Amy, you know, she was a saint. She really, you know, helped him out a lot. And, you know, she's kind of beating herself up, you know, wishing she could have done more when she did the most, and he wouldn't have made it where he is, or where he was, had it not been for her in the first place. And, you know, he'd been really good friends with Carrie Silken for Ring of Honor. And Carrie helped him out a great deal. And when Alex was at his roughest, you know, he was on radio stations burying Carrie and saying he did all these awful things. And that was very difficult for Carrie, because this was a guy that was, you know, a really close friend to him, that's turning around and, you know, saying all these awful things that really, they weren't valid at all. It was just his disease speaking. But at the same time, Carrie still did his best to help Alex. And, you know, like we just said, he even brought him back at Final Battle later that year, hoping that the fences would be mended and, you know, he'd be able to perform again.
Well, Chris, thanks again for doing the show today, and best of luck to you, and best wishes to everybody listening to this right now. And we really appreciate it. And, of course,
thank you, Chris.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, thank you for the forum, and, you know, thanks for everybody that, you know, supported him. I mean, his name was trending yesterday on Twitter, so
yeah,
a lot of people were talking about him, and I'd say, you know, they were overwhelmingly positive, at least from what I saw. So he touched a lot of people and affected them personally and professionally, and, you know, it's not going to be, you know, I don't think in my lifetime, I don't think anybody's going to forget about Larry Sweeney.
So thanks again, and of course, thanks everybody for listening. We'll talk to you again later on.